You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Thursday, November 14th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Democrats score on day one of impeachment hearings and all that jazz. Federal appeals court rules Congress can seek 8 years of Donald Trump's taxes. Meanwhile, speaking of Donald Trump, the U.S. held almost 70,000 migrant children in 2019. Infants, toddlers, elementary school kids. And in Bolivia, a Bolivian theocratic lawmaker declares herself president. Meanwhile, in this country, the Supreme Court allows Sandy Hook victims to go ahead with their suit against the Remington gun manufacturer. It's a big deal. On the campaign trail, Deval Patrick jumps in the race, joining John Delaney in the finance caucus. Republicans nervous about the Louisiana governor race this weekend. Trump's plan to drill on federal land in Utah halted by a lawsuit. Lastly, AOC and Sanders introduce a Green New Deal for public housing. And then, in a format change, interview with Stephen Kinzer, author of Poisoner in Chief, Sidney Gottlieb, and the CIA Search for Mind Control. All this and more on today's program. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. we have a skeletal crew today. Michael's out, Jamie out, and we've got to do. Obviously, we're starting a little bit early today. We're going to do the show in reverse order for the live folks, but we will flip it for the freebies. As always, you can become a member of this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show. You also get extra content every day. And you also get the free show commercial free. Okay, so yesterday we did a bunch of streaming. Obviously, you can go back. We have two segments that cover, I would say, about 90% of the hearings yesterday. And any of the highlights from that we did not get to, we will touch upon today. But the main gist of it was the Democrats wanted to do two things yesterday. And I will give a little bit of an analysis in a bit as to what I think their strategy was about. But they wanted to do two things. It was quite clear. One is they wanted to communicate to some audiences that the U.S., the implications of what Donald Trump did were, the stakes were high in terms of our relationship and the importance of our relationship and U.S. foreign policy toward Ukraine. And largely, George Kent, a State Department official, delivered that message. He had other things to talk about, but that was the big part that he needed, that he was brought in, I think, why they had him on day one. And then it was Ambassador Bill Taylor, who was the U.S. diplomat to Ukraine. And he was brought in to basically say, over time, I realized there was a two-track foreign policy with Ukraine. One, which represented U.S. foreign policy, The other, the irregular, he called them, that represented Donald Trump's personal interests. And I recognized when they started to diverge, these two tracks, and I came to understand what exactly what was going on. And he delivered that very well. The Republicans largely did not seem to be aware that this was going to happen yesterday. To the extent that they were successful at anything, I think they did make a case that Hunter Biden is a bit of a fail son and that we have a problem in this country with people trading off of their name and monetizing it, which I think is a fair assessment, largely irrelevant to the question of impeachment, but not so much if you're a Fox News viewer. And here's the point. Fox News, we got something similar to this, or this is Fox News Now. And they wanted, one of the things that was quite clear during the impeachment hearings, and it started very, very early, was you saw a lot of conservatives tweeting out, boring, very boring. And this was the line that was taken by the Republicans and the conservatives. This was their strategy from the beginning. Let's convince people not to watch it because it's boring. And after the fact, let's convince people that nobody watched it. It was irrelevant because it was boring. And here is Bill Bennett. They brought him on. I took him out of retirement. I don't know what his Bill Bennett is doing now.
He's got a Fox Nation show.
Oh, he does? Okay, yeah. Well, there you go.
At Steve Wynn's casino, where they sit in a round table and just talk.
Oh, is that right?
Talk shop.
Well, yeah. Steve Wynn doesn't own that casino anymore. Are we sure that show's still on?
Maybe not with Steve Wynn. After.
Right. Well, I mean, the bottom line is now the reason why they brought Bennett on here was because Bill Bennett was a Republican sort of pillar. And he was at one point the Secretary of Education, I think, under one of the Bushes. And it was subsequently found that he had a massive gambling problem that reached into, I think, millions of dollars, and that he was also apparently going to Vegas to gamble and then hooking up with a dominatrix, and he was married, and so it was a little bit scandalous. If I remember, that was at least the alleged rumor about him with the dominatrix. And so they brought him on to talk about how, you know, what it takes to make a scandal sexy. And here he is.
Americans are not buying the attacks on the president.
They're not buying the attacks and they're not interested. Look, this is a public event now, and there's no burglary, there's no break-in, there's no tapes, there's no dress, there's no sex, there's no Monica Lewinsky. Just interest just isn't there.
Yeah.
Plus, most important, there's no crime.
Okay. Now, I have two responses to this. One is that we are going to do most of our coverage with some background music that will jazz things up a little bit. Let's play a little sample of it. Yeah, we're going to do that as we do some of the coverage, because I think it was Reuters said there wasn't, or it was an NBC. Here it is, analysis. The first two witnesses called Wednesday to testify to President Trump's scheme, but lacked the pizzazz necessary to capture public attention. And we saw something similar, I think, with Reuters, like that had to do with pizzazz. So we're going to add some of that pizzazz. The other thing to remember here is that I don't know what the ratings were for that. I don't really know whether the American public was paying attention or not. There is one very narrow audience that the Democratic impeachment is targeted towards. I don't think there's anybody out there who genuinely believes that impeachment will move the needle in the context of the 2020 presidential election. I don't know that anyone has ever said that. I think had the Democrats not done this, I think they would have dampened their own enthusiasm. But I don't think there was anybody who ever said, if they impeach Donald Trump, he's gonna lose support. I think there have been people who said if you impeach Donald Trump, you could actually help Donald Trump. There's no evidence of either thing that's happening. His approval ratings have not moved. I guess it's conceivable they could drop a little bit if they make the case. And I guess it's conceivable that they could go up if the Democrats had handled this really poorly. And it's quite clear that they're not. The audience for this are in purple states. And they are going to be potential voters. And I say this over and over again. And I'm going to keep saying it because I, for some reason, I don't see anybody else saying it. And I'm surprised by that, which is not to say that I don't appreciate my own profundity, but I'm surprised that no one has made this point. When you talk about the importance of U.S. foreign policy towards Ukraine, when you talk about Bill Taylor's service to the United States in the military and whatnot, and Kent's long service as a part of the diplomatic corps, and as somebody who is nonpartisan, you might as well be talking to the voter that Susan Collins is trying to reach, or the voter that Cory Gardner is trying to reach, or the voter that Joni Ernst wants to reach, or Sally McAdams wants to reach, or Tom Tillis wants to reach. There may be even in Georgia. I mean, the playing field could expand. And the problem with that is not so much that you're looking to even convince those people. They may not even be paying attention. But in 6 to 8 months from now, when Susan Collins is trying to distance herself from Donald Trump, when Cory Gardner is trying to distance himself from Donald Trump, when Joni Ernst is trying to distance herself from Donald Trump. Remember, Joni Ernst even said there should be an examination of this. I'm following Grassley's lead here. They don't want to be hugged too tightly by Donald Trump. They also don't want to be crapped on by Donald Trump. And so what their plan was until any of this happened was to sort of toe that line and bob and weave and be noncommittal. But there's nothing that can commit you more than voting for or against impeachment of this president. And when Susan Collins votes not to impeach Donald Trump and her opponent says, how could you vote to protect Donald Trump? His word versus the word of these distinguished people like Ambassador Taylor and, you know, and George Kent. Guy wears a bow tie, for God's sakes. Susan Collins does not have the opportunity now to say that these people were, their testimony was in any way compromised. She is in a box. And what happened yesterday was that box got even harder and more rigid and less escape proof. That is what the whole import from a political standpoint will be in 2020. In the 2020 elections, it will be, and some congressional races too, I imagine, but mostly from the Senate perspective. Like I say, there would have been implications, I think, if Democrats had not done this, because I think that would have depressed some of the support for Democrats, broadly speaking, and it would have left a vacuum where Donald Trump and Bill Barr would be creating a whole myth now about, 2016 that is now automatically debunked. And we have people debunking that every day on our TV now in sworn testimony. And I think there was a ethical, civic responsibility to do this. But in terms of electoral politics, all of its meaning is going to be in the Senate races. And we will talk more about that in a moment and start to crank up the All That Jazz music. Let me tell you, one of today's sponsors is News Voice, which is the first ever entirely open crowdsourced and democratized platform for news. And you can download the app for free at newsvoice.com/majority. In a country where the vast majority of news is owned by the same five huge corporations, it's important for us to always pay attention to where our news is coming from, who owns which media outlets, what political biases may be in play. And that's exactly what News Voice helps you keep track of. News Voice is a free crowdsource website and mobile app that lets you create personal news feeds and maintain a clear picture of where your news is coming from and what political slants may exist. It helps you aggregate news from corporate outlets, international outlets, local news, and independent media. Hello. Giving you access to every side of every story. News Voice is fueled by its community of users who contribute to the platform by fact-checking, submitting stories, sources that are missing, upvoting stories, writing story summaries. It's one of the places I visit in the morning when I'm trying to collect stories of the day, and it gives me an opportunity to make sure that I've covered all my bases. You can also comment on stories. You debate politics with other members of the community. News Voice Play feature lets you listen to your personal news feed every day through customizable audio news playlists. It's your own personally tailored radio station for news. News Voice is a next generation news aggregator and social media platform that values transparency, good journalism, and productive political discussions. Get totally free access by going to newsvoice.com/majority. Put a link underneath this video if you're watching on YouTube. Of course, we put one in the podcast description as well. Also, Carrie Uma. It marries old school designs with new school ethics. Oh, grab my sneaker, dude. They want the shoes you wear to be made responsibly, feel crazy comfortable, and provide effortless style. And hello, ladies and gentlemen. Here they are. I'm keeping these babies clean. Because these are my going out on the town sneaks.
Like Lou Reed.
Right?
Yeah.
This is like the old old school style. I love it. But more comfortable, a little more support. And they make their sneakers by hand with premium natural materials. Like their canvas, which is made from cotton sourced via fair trade initiatives. Or, like I say, the cleaner premium leather, which is made with water that's been reused and treated with zero chemical waste output. Their outsole is even made out of raw natural rubber. Plus, their shipping is footprint balance. Their shipping footprint balance is zero. They offset, which is amazing considering they ship worldwide as well as here in the U.S. They even have express shipping and can deliver your shoes in just 2 to 3 business days. Then, if any reason they don't fit perfectly, you can return them free of charge. I'm loving these sneaks. And I showed them to my daughter. She said that was cool. I'm
that's a okay boomer.
Exactly.
Instead of a okay boomer.
Well, I mean, it's not okay boomer. I'm not a boomer.
I know. But that's the joke.
Okay, slacker. I know. Whatever. Okay, boomer. But for a limited time, our listeners can get an exclusive 15% off your first pair of Carrie Uma sneakers. Go to carrieuma.com/majority. Get 15% off. That's CARIUMA. .com/majority. That's CARIUMA. CARIUMA.com/majority for 15% off today. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program a senior fellow at the Watson Institute at Brown University and author of Poisoner in Chief: Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA and the Search for Mind Control. Stephen Kinzer, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
Let's start, obviously, maybe we should start first with just sort of the broad strokes of the CIA's desire. If you could contextualize, I guess, for us the context in which the CIA came to be interested in mind control.
This was an amazing project, which ultimately became known as MK Ultra. Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA, gave it that name because he believed, probably correctly, that if the CIA could find out a way to control people's minds, the prize would be nothing less than global mastery. So it would tower over other successes of the early Cold War, like overthrowing the government of Guatemala or overthrowing the government of Iran. He had this idea also that the Soviets were hot on the trail, or that indeed they had already discovered the secret to mind control. So, charged with this frenzy, Alan Dulles hired a most interesting guy who became the chief chemist of the CIA and also the director of MKUltra, which under his leadership became the most methodical and farthest reaching and most brutal search for techniques of mind control that have ever been launched in history.
All right, and before we get into MKUltra and to Sidney Gottlieb, just give us a little sense of Alan Dulles. I don't know if people, how familiar most folks are with the, and I think it was one of the, he was the longest running CIA director, I guess, at this point, and quite a character in and of himself.
Alan Dulles was a towering figure at the CIA. He dominated its early history. He came in near the very beginning. He actually helped draft the bill that created the CIA. And then all during the intense years of the Cold War, he was the CIA director. So it's difficult, of course, to piece together everything that the CIA did. And the story of MKUltra has only emerged in pieces because many of the records were destroyed in an effort to make sure that none of this ever came out. Alan Dulles, however, we can now say, was obsessed with this idea. He considered it the top priority of the CIA. And that's why he gave Sidney Gottlieb, the director of MKUltra, what amounted to a license to kill. In the course of Gottlieb's experiments, he was allowed to requisition human subjects, not just in the United States, but across Europe and in East Asia, where the CIA maintained secret detention centers where MKUltra experiments were carried out. And this network allowed Gottlieb to have essentially uncontrolled power as long as he was carrying out experiments that were aimed at doing something that he thought was a prerequisite to finding the key to mind control. Gottlieb believed, and Alan Dulles allowed him to go in this direction, that before you could find a way to insert a new mind into somebody's brain, you first had to find a way to destroy or blast away the mind that was already in there. So that was the goal of his experiments. And he spent 10 years trying to find ways to use drugs, electroshock, and all kinds of other techniques in ways that would allow him to destroy a human mind and a spirit and a body. And he did that for 10 years before finally concluding in the end, in the early 1960s, that actually mind control is a myth and the entire search had been fruitless.
All right, and we'll go through some of the details of that 10 years. But how, I'm struck by two questions. Is one is like, you know, why specifically Sidney Gottlieb? And two, is it possible there are other Sidney Gottliebs out there that we just don't know about?
Well, first of all, you ask why Sidney Gottlieb? And that is a fascinating question because I truly believe that I have stumbled on the most powerful unknown American of the 20th century. There can't have been anybody else who was allowed the freedom to do the things that he did on his own without really having any supervision at all. So Gottlieb was brought into the CIA as a 32-year-old chemist in 1951. But he was a very different figure from just about everybody else in the top ranks of the early CIA. All of those gentlemen knew each other from the Silver Spoon background of the same private schools and investment banks and law firms. Gottlieb was different. He was the parent, son of Orthodox Jewish immigrants in the Bronx. He went to City College. He limped. He stirred. He was a very different figure from the other CIA officers of that era. And he also had a very strange personal life. The way he lived was probably different from every other federal bureaucrat in 1950s Washington. He lived in a little cabin in the woods with no running water. He was into living at peace with the environment. He considered himself a compassionate humanist. He grew his own vegetables. He got up before dawn to milk his goats so he could make yogurt. He meditated. So by day, he was carrying out the most intense experiments on human subjects that have ever been conducted by any agency or officer of the U.S. government. And by night, he was living this life of the contemplative father and husband who lived off the land and were spiritually in touch with all the world around them. So he had Jekyll and Hyde thing going in a big way. And your second question, could there be other Gottliebs? I tell you something, this story is shocking even to me. You know, this book is my 10th book. But it's the first book I've written that I'm shocked by. I still can't believe that all of this happened. And as I've turned it over in my mind during the years I've been working on this project, naturally, I've asked myself the question that you asked. So if there was a Gottlieb then, think of how much further advanced is the secret world and how far further along the technology is, how much vaster is the computer potential. So it would be naive to think that Gottlieb, as the CIA later tried to present him, was just one crazy guy who managed to slip through the net of the CIA that normally makes sure that nothing this extreme happens. It's certainly plausible and probable, I would say, that maybe in a generation or two, there'll be somebody exactly like me having a chat with somebody exactly like you, talking about something that's happening in 2019, but people back then didn't know anything about.
Well, and to that point, and I want to get to the details of the story that do make it so shocking. But is it possible that there was other Gottlieb's contemporaneous? Like, I mean, I just wonder, like, they didn't do it. You know, they certainly tried, right, to cover up all of the existence of this program. I wonder if it's possible that there were others that they were more successful with.
At the end of Gottlieb's career, he had to appear before a couple of congressional investigating committees. He was able to do this in private, and he never really had to touch any of the most sensitive things that he had done. However, he did complain that in many of the documents with which he was confronted, there were various signatures. All were blacked out and redacted, as they say, except for his. And he kept saying, why me? Why is my signature the only one that nobody ever blacked out when they decided to release these documents? And that, I think, made him reflect back on something we just talked about, which is how different he was, what an outsider he was at the CIA. I think that when the truth of MKUltra began to come out in drips and drabs, the CIA's response was to say, well, as William Colby, the CIA director, said when asked about this once by some MKUltra victims, some of our people were out of control in those days. There were problems of supervision. So essentially, this is a way to avoid all institutional responsibility and say, well, it was all Gottlieb's fault. Could there have been others? I don't think there was anybody running a program like this. Because Gottlieb had authority to travel around Europe and East Asia directing experiments like none that have ever been conducted in the U.S. government. So he really was a person who not only carried out these experiments, but conceived the entire program. Wow. And I tell you, one of his favorite drugs, his all-time favorite drug was LSD, which he himself said he used at least 200 times. And when I read that and I started reflecting on how bizarre were some of these horrific experiments that he carried out, I even asked myself, when wondering how you could conceive of these experiments, did he conceive of some of them while he was actually using LSD, on his favorite drug, and then letting his mind go off in this grotesque direction?
Well, let's talk about MKUltra. So it sets out he's tasked, right, with this idea of like, we want you to learn how to brainwash people, but before we can implant ideas in their minds, we have to break them down. So was it did he then decide like, okay, well then I'm going to use a wide range of techniques to do it. Like, let's go through some of those. I mean, one you've touched on is just like basically dosing people. But go through the lengths in which, like, how long over the course of those 10 years was LSD like, okay, we're going to start with every patient that we have, every subject of this experiment is going to get LSD, and then we're going to do other things? Or was it cocktails of different drugs? Or, what was his, I guess, scientific approach?
First thing he did was to ask himself, like a good scientist, what research already exists? So who's out there that's already an expert in this field? And the field is how to destroy a human mind and a soul and a human body, and how to use drugs to do that and try to control people. Well, the obvious answer was the Nazi doctors who had carried out experiments in the concentration camps. And those Nazi doctors, along with some of their Japanese counterparts, came to work for MKUltra projects. I tell you, I, while doing the research for this book, visited what I think was the first CIA secret prison. It's in a beautiful chalet in Germany. And the young German businessman who owns it took me down into the basement. And he said to me, these were the cells in which the MKUltra doctors and their Nazi counterparts carried out experiments that were just continuations of the experiments that those same Nazi doctors had been carrying out just a few years earlier.
Right, this is 1952,
down the
right?
road. Exactly. We're right in the early 1950s now. So what kinds of experiments were those? So, for example, that safe house or others like it in Germany, an experiment like this might be carried out. I found one in which people were, the victims would be placed in a sensory deprivation chamber like a coffin, and then injected with barbiturates, so they would fall into a deep coma. Then after a period like that, they would be suddenly injected with overdoses of amphetamines that would make them hyperactive. And while they were in the transition phase between coma and hyperactivity, they were given overdoses of electroshock to see if this whole combination delivered at that moment might be something that could destroy a person's mind or kill someone. And in fact, the same German businessman I was telling you about who owns what was then the CIA torture house told me people in the neighborhood, the older residents, have told me that in the forests around here is where they buried the victims who were experimented to death. And most of those places are now covered by shopping malls and apartment blocks. So those were victims who the CIA documents charmingly call expendables, like refugees who nobody was connected to or suspected enemy agents that the CIA had captured. In East Asia, many of the victims were North Korean prisoners of war. So Gottlieb had the right essentially to requisition people to carry out experiments, and then he would go over or send other MK Ultra teams over to carry out these experiments. Now, inside the United States, Gottlieb also carried out experiments, although here he did not have the actual license to kill people because he had what was called in the CIA documents the disposal problem. He didn't have that over in the Philippines or in Korea or Japan or Germany. So he would carry out experiments often in federal prisons for obvious reasons. He liked using inmates. I found one MK Ultra experiment, for example, that was carried out in a federal prison in Kentucky. In this experiment, seven African-American inmates were segregated into a cell, and without being told what was happening to them, were given overdoses of LSD every day for 77 days. The purpose of this experiment was to find out if that amount of LSD over that long period of time could destroy a person's mind. The protocols from that experiment were among the records that have been destroyed and lost, but I strongly suspect that the answer to that experiment question was yes. I'm sure those people's minds were destroyed, so the experiment would have been a success. What happened to them, who they were, is something I don't think we'll ever know, but it's something I still wonder about every time I think about this experiment. So these were all ways that Gottlieb tried to find a way to create a void in a human mind, only to be finally persuaded that you actually cannot ever, for example, make a person go out and commit murder if that person is deeply opposed to murder. It turned out that was a fantasy adapted from fiction and triggered by Cold War fears. But the process of pursuing that fear laid waste to many lives.
Is that what they were looking for? It's like a Manchurian candidate where they can just, you know, or what was it? The boys from Brazil or telephone or whatever it was, where it's like, you know, we just call up. All I got to do is read a get this guy on the phone and then say a poem by Thoreau, and they go off and commit some type of espionage or something.
Yeah, that's certainly one of the goals that Gottlieb was seeking, a way to program a person to commit crimes and then not only forget who had ordered him to commit the crimes, but forget that he'd even committed them at all. They were also looking for other things. For example, a truth serum. How do you get a prisoner to reveal everything that he knows? And in fact, Gottlieb was the author of the first CIA memo based on his years of experience about how to break down prisoners and make them totally reliant on the interrogator. That document in various different incarnations has gone all the way through Vietnam and Latin America and up to Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. So in a way, MK Ultra has definitely influenced the development of the techniques that we now call enhanced interrogation.
Have you or has anyone located, you know, I guess, subjects or victims of this? I mean, I know Whitey Bulger apparently was one of those guys who was dosed while in prison, right? Were there others? I mean, you couldn't locate those seven African-American prisoners. Were there others who gave like a firsthand account to this? I mean, I can only imagine the suffering that you know, those seven guys went through.
The worst of it is that, of course, nobody even knew that MK Ultra existed or that there was some guy from the CIA roaming around America and the rest of the world dosing people with LSD in various ways without their knowledge, just to observe their reactions. And nobody would have believed them if they had said so. So it wasn't until about 20 years after the experiments went on that the first news of them began to trickle out. And then at the beginning, there was a bit of a series of people slowly realizing that this might have been what happened to me. And you're right, Whitey Bulger, the famous Boston gangster, was one person who came to this conclusion. He suddenly realized it. So Whitey Bulger's story is just one that we know. You can multiply this by many others. But it's one of the ways I put my book together, by trying to weave in the various stories that we have. So in Whitey Bulger's case, he was a young hoodlum in his mid-20s when he was sent to the Atlanta prison for truck hijacking. There he was approached by one Dr. Pfeiffer, a very eminent figure who was also the chief of a prominent department at Emory University. And he was asked to be one of the prisoners participating in an experiment aimed at finding a cure for schizophrenia. If Whitey Bulger were to cooperate, he was told that he would have better treatment in prison and good time and so forth. So he agreed. He didn't know what he was being given. All he knew was it was something that had to do with curing schizophrenia. Well, what it was in the end, it was actually LSD. And he was fed LSD just about every day for more than a year. And later on, he wrote a detailed diary for himself after he got out of prison of what happened and how awful it was and what he used to see in his prison cell, and how since then he's had nightmares every night of his life and he can't sleep. He has to have the lights on at night. But he didn't say anything to anybody because, as he wrote in his diary, I thought if I said anything, they'd never let me out. But he's just one example. And I discovered in one book on Whitey Bulger that at one point in the 1970s, when the news about MKUltra came out, he realized that that experiment had nothing to do with schizophrenia. It was a CIA experiment aimed at mind control. And he told the other gangsters that he hung out with that he was going to find that Dr. Pfeiffer. He's going to go back to Atlanta and he was going to kill him. Pfeiffer died a natural death, apparently, not so long after. So Whitey Bulger never carried out that threat. But he's an example of somebody who finally put it all together. But what he didn't know was what was behind Dr. Pfeiffer. And that's because Sidney Gottlieb, even then, was totally invisible. And part of the challenge of my book is to write a biography of a person who lived in such deep anonymity.
Tell us about Operation Midnight Climax. that is, it's quite a name.
So Gottlieb was interested in trying everything possible that had to do with drugs and see if combinations of drugs with all kinds of other techniques might not help him understand ways to make people talk more freely and open their minds to outside control. At one point, he came up with the idea that he'd like to test the effect of mixing sex with drugs. The question was something like, was there a combination of drugs and sexual techniques that would make men speak more freely or in some way open up their brain to control? So, in pursuit of this highly scientific project, he set up a bordello in San Francisco on Telegraph Hill, and he had an agent, a very colorful federal narcotics officer, set up a ring of prostitutes who brought their clients up to this apartment and then dosed their drinks with LSD or whatever drug it was that Gottlieb wanted to try out that week. And meanwhile, Gottlieb's agent would be sitting on the other side of the one-way mirror on his portable toilet, drinking martinis out of a pitcher and writing down what he saw through the mirror. That was the extent of the deep clinical analysis. So this operation, this CIA-sponsored bordello, which was essentially your tax dollars at work trying to find a way to protect America from communism, was indeed known at the CIA as Operation Midnight Climax, and really represents one of the most bizarre extremes of Gottlieb's mind control experiment.
If they were aware of this, you know, at the agency, like what was the perspective? Like this guy's twisted. We're all twisted. Look, the whole thing, put aside the fact that it's, you know, some guy's behind a one-way mirror, or two-way mirror, I guess. Recording this, what was their perspective? Was it just like, this is a project we're doing, it's going to get a little weird, but we have it at arm's length enough so that we can say this guy's a freak and he just got out of control and he wasn't filing his weekly reports properly or something?
You know, you're not actually that far off. So at the CIA, I realized as I was investigating the project that led to this book, there's a certain culture that I think also exists at other secret services, and that is that ignorance is often an asset. You don't want to know too much. It implicates you. So at the CIA, I think there were only a very few people who had an idea of what Gottlieb was doing. Alan Dulles was certainly one. Richard Helms, who was sort of the intermediary between Gottlieb and Dulles, was another. Since those guys, Dulles and Helms in particular, understood that Gottlieb was carrying out this urgent project and that they knew this would involve experiments that would be brutal, that blood was being shed, that people were probably being killed, did not lead them to decide they needed to supervise this much more carefully. It led them to the contrary conclusion. Since we know in our heart that these things are happening, we don't want to ask any questions. This is so important, that's why it's called MK Ultra, that the loss of a few lives or a few hundred lives is certainly a small price to pay. Meanwhile, by not asking too many questions, we insulate ourselves and allow ourselves in the future to say we didn't know anything. In this way, Gottlieb essentially worked without any supervision. I do think there would have been a mind control project, something like MK Ultra, without Dulles and Gottlieb, but it wouldn't have gone to such crazy extremes. And this is really an example of how far the project was allowed to go based on the misplaced terrors of that age.
So aside from the story being, you know, completely nuts and it being incredibly compelling, when you look back on this entire saga, what are the lessons that you take from it? Are they narrowly tailored to just the CIA? Is it about sort of the way that people wash themselves of responsibility? What's the big takeaway?
I think that the ultimate justification for committing immoral acts is commitment to a great cause. Patriotism is one of the most transcendent and seductive of all causes. Gottlieb lived at a time in which all Americans were led to believe that we were at the moment of imminent destruction and that therefore any sacrifice was necessary. In a way, that could be a little bit of a message for us today. We too now are being told that we're at a moment of special emergency and our country faces threats. Therefore, although we normally behave according to all international rules and of ethics and morality, because of the emergency we face now, temporarily we have to give up some of our normal virtues and carry out operations in other countries that we might not otherwise have to do, and we have to give up certain civil liberties at home. So it's a danger. I think Gottlieb lost sight of an elemental moral calculation. You always have to ask yourself, is there an amount of evil you do in the service of what you think is a good cause that finally begins to outweigh the goodness of the cause? I think Gottlieb lost sight of that. And it's a message not to be carried away by the fears of the moment and lose one's bearings by thinking that any sacrifice is now necessary. Once you do that, especially when secret agencies do it, you begin to go down a path in which human life is devalued and so is democracy.
Yeah, and it's arguable that Gottlieb made any sacrifices. It sounds like there was those sacrifices were offloaded to a lot of people who weren't even aware that they were making them. The book is Poisoner in Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA Search for Mind Control. Stephen Kinzer, thanks so much for your time today. We will put a link to that book at majority.fm. Real pleasure. Fascinating story.
Great to be with you. Thanks.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know. Choice was made for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive.